Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. On the show, we've got Ella Huff. Ella is a college student right now, but she is a Bitcoin maxi and was a fantastic conversation. We talk about her upbringing. She had a very unique and very cool upbringing. I want to have her mom on sometime to talk. We talked about Gen Z and its adoption of Bitcoin, all the things that she's working on, and I really think you're going to enjoy my conversation with Ella. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Ella here. Ella, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
I really appreciate you taking time. I know that you have a hectic schedule these days. You've got your hands in a lot of things. You're a student. You've got all sorts of fun stuff going on. So really grateful to have the time. I was telling you before we hit record, I've heard you on podcasts before. Know who you are, know who your mom is, very thoughtful Bitcoiners in your own right. But I was listening to a podcast that the two of you were on together with Jimmy Song just in the last month or so, and was taking a lot of notes on some of the parenting styles. I'm always interested in what people who are breaking the mold of parenting and raising kids are interested in and doing, because I've got three of my own and it's busy and you want what's best for them. So I wanted to start by giving you an opportunity to talk in more detail about your upbringing. Can you maybe just tell me a bit about what it was like growing up in the Huff household?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much, Michael, for having me. So I'm an only child. So I think that's good context as well. But I grew up in Houston, just me. And I guess the first thing that pops into my mind is my parents really treated me like I was my own individual. My opinion was just as valid as anyone else's. We never had a kids table anywhere. We were over at friends, my parents always made sure I sat with them, that I was just an equal member of all conversations. And looking back, I think that was really impactful on my life today and what I think I'm capable of accomplishing, just because from so early, my parents just reassured me that I was competent and valued. So that was probably just one defining thing that I remember. But to put it in maybe a more memorable phrase, my mom has this quote about how she wanted to be my swim coach, not my lifeguard. So she wasn't going to come in and save me. She's going to teach me how to swim, and then I could go on my way. So I think that's just some context of what the day-to-day was like.
What did you notice? So those are good examples. Are there things that you noticed that other people, other families were doing that were distinctly different from the way you were growing up? Like, was that observable at a young age?
Possibly. So in the summer, for instance, no TV. I was only reading. So I read maybe 100 books a summer. And granted, they were not, long, huge novels, but I didn't see other friends necessarily doing that. I did not receive a phone until maybe eighth grade, seventh grade, many years after everyone else in my grade did. I'm trying to think some others. Most of my friends were also only children. So I spent a lot of time with them, and I don't know. I think that was a pretty typical growing up. You go to the park after school, all that's the same. But I think those two pieces really come to top of mind.
For example, getting a phone later than everyone else. Did you understand the importance of that, or was it frustrating? Did your parents have to sit you down and sort of explain what was going on, or were you just accepting of everything that came your way?
Yeah, I was just accepting. I didn't get an allowance when I was little. It was just more from, we're a part of our family team. Everyone pitches in and does their job. So I didn't really question or ask for much. Like, I never made a Christmas list. Maybe I did when I was five or something. But I never made a Christmas list of this is what I want, or any material thing really just wasn't of interest to me. Also, a lot of people my age would have a phone, and then they'd want social media and Instagram and Snapchat. And honestly, it all just seemed like a foreign concept to me. I was like, I have no idea what I would post. So I'm good. I don't need that. I was sort of the class homework helper, I guess you could phrase it like that. And people would just email me questions, and that worked. It also kept me out of a lot of the drama, I would say. most other parents kind of would tell my mom that, oh, Ella lives under a rock. She doesn't know any of the dramatics that's going on. So I think I was good in my, you know, world of how things played out. I didn't feel like anything was missing.
Yeah, that's you lived a much more liberated childhood than you might even fully appreciate, knowing some of the nonsense that goes on. And were you in public schools or private homeschooled?
I went to an all-girls school for pretty much my whole life up until eighth grade. And then I did my first year of high school at a co-ed high school. It was a boarding school, 10th grade and onwards back to all girls, except for a little period when I was studying abroad in Beijing.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So I want to hit on one more thing. You talked about allowances and I think I'm generally on the same page as your parents with allowances. Like, I think you contribute to the household because you're a member of the family, you're a part of the team, not because you did something and you deserve, you know, a cookie. Mm-hmm. But I heard this interesting, and again, in the same logic might apply here. So this might be silly that I'm bringing this up as a potential option, but I heard on this podcast, this guy said he never gave his kids allowances. If they wanted something, the currency of their home was books. And so if you read 20 books, you will get you that thing. And, and I thought that at least seems a lot better than chores. The only potential downside of that, of course, is are you incentivizing reading only because there's this reward versus reading for its own sake? I'm curious if that sort of thing, like, I guess maybe my question for you is maybe what do you think about that? But secondarily, if you did want something as you got a little bit older and it maybe became more appropriate for you to say, hey, I would like, you know, whatever, how did you afford that before you were working and producing income for yourself?
Yeah. So to your first question, I think I also heard this is how Saylor got really interested in sci-fi. I might get the story a little bit wrong, but his parents did something similar where he, depending how many books he read, I think he got some allowance. And so he has this joke or way of saying it where he just picked the books with the least amount of words and the images. And it's at the end of one of his Atlas Network podcasts. So someone can fact check me there. But to your point of if we force something on you, then are you less interested in doing it for yourself? I think there's a balance, but it also goes back to just how I was raised with my parents wanting me to make my own decisions, you know, parenting from a place of we think you make good decisions, we trust you. So that layer was there. A lot of choice was always given. So for instance, when I was really little, my parents would say, Ella, do you want to take a bath or do you want to take a shower? Like for them, they didn't care. I was going to be clean at the end of the process, but I got to choose what I wanted to do. So I think the earlier you start with your kids and how you talk to them and your dynamic that you set, then probably takes away any concern over if you're forcing them to do something and then they don't want to do it anymore because they don't feel like it's their choice. If you always have that base layer of choice there. And then to your second question about how did I afford something before I had a job? So I, for gifts, like for Christmas or my birthday, I might get some money from grandparents or my parents, and I saved everything. I would also, so my dad would come home and he might have a lot of, you know, change in his pockets, and I would collect that change and then I would roll it up into the sleeves and then you can take it to the bank and deposit it and they'll give you the cash. So I would do stuff like that. I had gifts from family. And then I remember the first purchase I ever made, I spent like $200 on an American Girl doll that I really wanted. And I bought it entirely myself. So my parents said, you know, Ella, you really want this? Well, you have the money. You can buy that for yourself, but that's your decision to make, your choice. And I would say I'm much more of a saver than a spender just in general, but I just saved everything. And then if I wanted to make a purchase, I could.
That's cool. Last question on your upbringing, because I know this is a Bitcoin podcast, but I think there are a lot of Bitcoiners who are having lots of kids and they're thinking about these things, and your parents seem to have done exceptionally well. I'm curious, like, discipline. Mm-hmm. And I know that like my oldest is 6 years old. She's a girl, obviously, and she's a lot like her mom. And there's sort of a stereotype of firstborn girls in many cases, not all the time, obviously, that they, you know, like my wife was a rule follower. She was very well behaved, very mild mannered, never got in mm-hmm. trouble, aims to please. And like my daughter is a lot like that. And, you know, so it looks, but, you know, she has her moments. She's got a little bit of her dad in her too. And so she, you know, pushes the boundaries a little bit and does some dumb things sometimes. And that's just part of our gig that we've signed up for. Mm-hmm. Did your parents ever have like a specific way that they would discipline you when you were younger, or, were you kind of just a hassle-free kid generally? What was the landscape?
Past the first 2 years of my life, I think I was a pretty hassle-free kid. We joke that I cried all of the tears God gave me in the first 2 years of my life, and then I was just kind of happy from there on out. So I don't really remember. I don't think I ever got disciplined.
In any traditional sense?
No. There was no timeout chair. I'm trying to think back. There was none of that. None of, you know, we're going to take your phone away, or we're going to take this away from you. Again, like the team mentality was really big, but on discipline in terms of not from like a negative punishment connotation, but just of how I went about my daily life. Two things my parents did. One, pretty early on when I was in high school, maybe even middle school, they said, you know, Ella, our job is we're going to get you to the finish line of when you graduate college. Like that is, it's not that that's not the end, that's the starting line. But then you're on your own. You need to take care of yourself. And I think that's very fair. Like when I graduate in May, well, it's all on me. So I knew that going into it, like I needed to ensure my own success. I needed to be able to take care of myself. And then the second, my dad came home one night and shared a quote with me from Jerry Rice, which is essentially, today I will do what others won't, so tomorrow I can achieve what others can't. And those words have just been in my head, and I see them every day since, I don't know, maybe fourth or fifth grade, I want to say. And about that time-ish, the TV show Madam Secretary came out. And I hate to say I was influenced by a TV show, but I decided I really wanted to be Secretary of State. And I was like, okay, you know, how am I going to do it? And so I just set that as a big goal and smaller goals to work into that. And having something that you can look at just as a guide, you don't even need to accomplish that, but something that you kind of put your energy towards is really helpful, and then just makes all the day-to-day discipline more effective as well.
Yeah, I love that quote. I remember you mentioning that on Jimmy's podcast. It's a good one. Well, I'll say something semi-controversial. I think more people are coming around to this, but like in my own life with young kids, I'm something of a physical discipline maximalist. I heard this guy talking once about, I have a very sweet, loving relationship with my children. All they want to do is play with me as often as mm-hmm. they possibly can. But I remember hearing this, someone speak about like these phases of life that you go through with your kids. And the first, call it 5 years, are like discipline. They don't really understand right from wrong, or you can't really reason as effectively. And so you need to discipline them. You can't do that. You can do this, that sort of thing. And then you enter a teaching phase where you begin to explain the reasoning behind a lot of things, when they can kind of understand that. And if you go out of order and you're still trying to discipline your kids, and like to your point, like I've no timeout, we don't do timeout, we're taking this away. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to use those tactics on a 15-year-old, it backfires. And that's where you get like very rebellious kids, because you're treating them the way a 3-year-old might need to be treated, but not you've gone to, it's too late. Mm-hmm. You should have taken care of that when they're young, instilled these lessons. It sounds to me like maybe your parents, because of maybe just your nature to some degree, were able to very quickly and fluidly move into like this teaching stage of life with you. Does that seem, you know, there wasn't a lot of discipline required, and so they could just begin imparting, you know, wisdom upon you from a young age. Does that seem reflective of what you?
Yeah, I just think there was a very high level of respect just the from the get-go. That's just the first thing I remember. Any serious conversation that might happen, it was had in front of me. I didn't feel like I was lesser than, even though, you know, maybe I just was younger, I just had less experience. But I just think the level of respect, that bar was set really high, and it went both ways. And then that totally voided, the needing to deal with discipline and maybe perhaps something of what you were just mentioning. And also, how do I phrase this? So every weekend we would all cook breakfast together and then sit around a table and just read and talk and listen to each other. And then we would do things in our community. So maybe a thread is just getting to a place of substance and value. And how do you just live your life of being a good human for, you know, your local community, your local family, but also your neighbors and your peers? So maybe to give an example, there's maybe a TED Talk or somewhere when it's this soccer coach and he's trying to discipline his team. And instead of calling out when someone did something wrong, he would only call out when someone did something right. And then the performance drastically increased when he would compliment how someone did something. So rather than, let's say I'm doing the dishes, which was my job every night, and setting the table, rather than saying, Ella, you put the knife on the wrong side of this, my mom could say, oh, I love how you aligned the fork and the spoon. So just coming from a place of respect and positive feedback, I also think is helpful.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, absolutely. I see that. I mean, my son is only 3. My other daughter's only 10 months old, 9 months old. But I see that more and more with my daughter, like that positive reinforcement when she's accomplishing something or doing something the right way. I mean, it's nice that like I'm at a place where, especially with her, that she understands and appreciates the positive feedback, and that reinforcement is just so important. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. All right. I've asked you enough about your childhood. I appreciate you indulging me. I'm just always curious how good people turn out good. So tell me a little bit about Bitcoin. How did you get into Bitcoin? When did this start, and what was the path you took?
Yes, absolutely. So I know I've said this a lot, so I'll keep it to the spark notes, the brief summary on this one. But I found it in high school. My school had a technology innovation and entrepreneurship program, and there was a class in there called blockchain that I signed up for because I elected to pursue the innovation part of the certificate. And at the time, I was really interested in just AI and ethics in AI. That's what I was thinking about for college. So I went to class and I thought, okay, this is interesting, cool, but not really where I want to put my full time and focus. And I'm still just a curious person. So outside of that class, I was taking like the Gary Gensler MIT Blockchain and Money course, listening to an occasional podcast here or there. At the same time, my mom was really learning about it. She was maybe a little bit earlier than me. So when we'd call and talk with the phone at night, inevitably it would come up. But then it wasn't until I graduated high school and finished my first year of college, which happened to be all online because I was at NYU Shanghai and we couldn't actually make it there. And that summer after my freshman year, my mom and I went to the Oslo Freedom Forum, put on by the Human Rights Foundation. And it was on that plane ride back where I say I really just decided to focus my full time and energy over to Bitcoin.
Okay. So I'm curious because we talked a little bit about money growing up for you and how mm-hmm. how you came by it, saved a lot. Was there something that your parents sort of instilled in you with respect to money that you think made Bitcoin something you could grasp as a young adult in high school? Like, were there like foundational building blocks of understanding what money was for, what it was intended to do, the economic weight of having money and savings, or did you just kind of trip into Bitcoin in this moment in high school?
I don't know. I think I was in the fortunate position where I couldn't trip into it. Like, I grew up in the US and so much financial privilege compared to many other places in the world where I wasn't just tripping into, okay, what is anything out there that can help me, you know, have savings and preserve myself into the future. I look at it more of a combination of different events that really made me grasp it. But to specifically answer your question on the money piece, as I mentioned, my parents said, Ella, when you graduate, like, you're on your own. And in, I'm forgetting the timeline, but somewhere when I'm deciding where am I going to go to school, what am I going to study, my mom sat me down and we made an Excel spreadsheet of just how expensive it is to just go outside and breathe, essentially. So we put in, you know, what major, what's the average starting salary, where do I want to live, what's the rent like, what are my, you know, retirement contributions, just everything. What are my expenses? How much am I going to spend on groceries? Just all of that. And very quickly, we got a big red number. That it was just not going to work. And I think we did it for like a history major because I was really interested in history. And I had made the comment that I don't want to just do a job for money, but I really just, the dots had not connected yet. So that's when I realized, no, I need an engineering degree or a computer science degree or something of that nature. So that was very helpful. Just the, you know, straight up how expensive it is to actually take care of yourself. But more on the other points that helped me. My freshman year of college, I had taken a class on creativity. And in that class, they talk about how creativity, it's not just a product or an output, but it's sort of a process of how you go about life. And everyone has the ability to be creative. There's lots of different ways to be creative. And it was a seminar style class where we did a semester long project or study of a creator of our choosing. And I chose Kathy Wood. And so that hearing all she talks about with creative destruction and disruptive innovation, that was another really big point in my understanding. And then probably another one that I didn't really know at the time was when I studied abroad in Beijing. And just being exposed to things like a social credit score or how your entire life can be in a single app that the government can monitor and track. Having all of these touch points and then so having gathering those touch points, collecting those dots, this is another kind of phrase I like, collecting dots and then connecting them. When I then was sitting in the Oslo concert, I'm seeing the word in but I think it's like the concert house is where it is. And you're hearing all these people tell these stories. It's just when all of these different inputs that you've been gathering, you know, prior in life come together and really magnified why I need to focus on Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of the reason I was asking that question is because like I mentioned, I have a 6-year-old daughter and I'm trying to piece together the best way of beginning to teach her about money. And she's a smart kid and she's at an age where I can reasonably expect to begin imparting some of that knowledge on her. Yeah. I'm curious if you have like any sort of tangible tips for how do you broach that subject with, you know, someone of that age to begin putting these pieces in place for them so that way when they're presented with this opportunity of Bitcoin someday or, you know, whatever opportunities that they say, okay, like they've collected enough dots to begin, you know, connecting them.
I mean, I think there is something to be said for knowing kind of two sides. So you're able to compare and really see the benefit of why one thing is better than the other. But for her, I mean, she has this huge, you know, she doesn't need to learn how fiat works. I mean, she can so that she can understand why Bitcoin is so much better. But I think it's really exciting, you know, all the younger generations, they are at this stage where they're sort of at the beginning because they never teach you anything about money or financial security in school, that you have a lot less assumptions that you have to unlearn. You can just actually learn. You don't have all these things that you've taken for granted. So for her, I love DeBiFi's phrase, own your money. And one of the analogies I use when I talk to people about self-custody is just picture a piggy bank, like when you're little and you might have a piggy bank where you keep, you know, your coins or whatever you're gathering. You know, we all secure our wealth. Granted, it's very small at that time. But then I remember I was so excited when I finally got a debit card. And I look back now, I'm like, why was I just so excited to hand over my money to someone else to manage? Like, I can do this myself. Having agency and realizing the importance of self-sovereignty is hugely important. So for your kids, I think just teach them about Bitcoin. Teach them also critically about the values that Bitcoin embodies, and, you know, why it's important we protect those. And then when they're presented with how, you know, our monetary system works today, they will be working off of this already better system rather than the inverse, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, because I almost feel, even though obviously my conviction in Bitcoin is incredibly high, it almost feels like I need to sort of explain like how the world works, but then why there's this better option. But that might be just reinforcing bad habits, you know, and it might make more sense to start with how money should work. And then when she's trying to piece together, but why do the banks hold why do the banks hold this money or whatever? It doesn't make sense because it shouldn't make sense. You know, like it might be a better way of sort of approaching it. That's interesting. Okay. So you learned about Bitcoin in high school, and, interesting that the Oslo Freedom Forum was, sort of the impetus for your, I guess your maximalism, to some degree. Was there a specific attribute of Bitcoin, like, you know, its scarcity, its decentralization, or maybe some use case, you know, banking the unbanked or something else that like really resonated with you, where you said, this is really something that I need to study and involve myself with?
Yes, I think probably it was the protection of the individual and just the importance of how, you know, each person matters in this world, and Bitcoin is the best tool we have to protect you, yourself, you know, today, tomorrow, in the future. I think that probably really resonated with me, just the what Bitcoin gives you to be able to pursue what makes you happy, where you find joy, gives you the ability to have freedom of thought, to think for yourself. Probably maybe the emphasis on the human. And also, I don't know if that's just top of mind right now, because we are recording on October 31st, and I love how network is mentioned 21 times in the white paper. So that could also just be top of mind right now.
Yeah. All right. So you're studying, I think, cognitive science, and also you got approved for an independent major in Bitcoin. Is that correct?
Yes. So I am in the College Scholar Program, which is the Robert S. Harrison College Scholar Program, which is an independent major program where you design your own study major, and then you get to choose your transcript or the title on your transcript. And then I also have a cognitive science major, and then three minors in information science, business, and moral psychology.
Okay. So I've never been a part of anything with the word scholar in it. So I'm curious, I've heard about people designing their own major, that sort of thing. What does that actually mean? What was the approval process like? And what classes do you take? You know, my assumption is there aren't 20 Bitcoin classes for you to pick from at Cornell. So what are you actually doing with that side of your degree program?
Yes, no, you're exactly right. There's not a Bitcoin class yet.
Yet.
And actually, yeah. But I also hope it kind of just, I love how interdisciplinary Bitcoin is. I think it's the most interdisciplinary. So I ideally, probably Bitcoin just sits above any one discipline, and you could look at it from all different areas. I don't think there can't be just one Bitcoin class. Like, it's just going to be a part of everything. It took 15 months for this major to be approved. I started in the independent major program. So a variety of universities in the U.S. have something like this. NYU has their Gallatin program. WashU St. Louis has something called Beyond Boundaries. Essentially, how they're all kind of proposed is there is some topic out there that you're really passionate about that doesn't fit within our established curriculum, or that you don't see listed on our website, but that you want to study. So basically pitch it to us, and then you draft up a list of what courses you think will help you pursue that topic. And you also, in my case for the College Scholar program, you put together a committee where you kind of defend whatever your final project is. So for me, it'll be a final thesis project, but there's nuance to all the different programs and how they look. But that is what I am doing with that. So I have a committee. You submit a normal application, like why you want to study this, a personal statement, a research proposal, a course list. And you can take courses from anywhere in, I'm in the College of Arts and Sciences, anywhere in the college, and I believe also from other schools as well. And so some courses that I am taking, for instance, taking one, the evolution of language, language and technology, event segmentation, just a thesis course. So that's some of my courses this semester. But really, I found myself sitting in all of my classes and jotting notes about Bitcoin in the margins. And so having this program where I can just the ability to just think about it in a more structured way is really nice, and why I wanted to pursue that.
That is really cool. So my graduate degree is actually from WashU. I'm here in St. Louis. So I'm glad to hear they have this sort of program as well.
Yeah.
Is the 15 months required for approval? Is that typical, or was that a long time?
No, that was a long time. I transferred to Cornell my sophomore year, and the second I got there, actually came in as a computer science and China and Asia Pacific studies major. And then the summer before I transferred, I saw they started a cognitive science program. And I had just taken this course on creativity about the importance of questions and seeking questions over answers. So I made the switch to cognitive science. And then I saw when I was doing that process that they had an independent major program, which then marked the beginning of the 15 months. And over the course of that whole year, I was writing the proposals, trying to get just one faculty to agree to sponsor it. And that proved incredibly challenging. And then very unfortunately, the man who ran the program, he passed away. And then I got back to school my junior year, still kind of kept trying. And then I found the College Scholar program. And actually, I was allowed to apply and applied within a span of like a week or 2 weeks over exams. And then I think I found out in January that I could do it.
Okay. Very good. So besides your work as a student, you're also running the Bitcoin Students Network, if I understand that right. Could you talk a little bit about what this is? What's the mission? How do you think about measuring success with an organization like that?
Yes, happy to. So the Bitcoin Students Network, we launched it in March of last year at the Bitcoin Atlantis Conference. And it started partly because I started the Cornell Bitcoin Club. And there's quite a lot of effort that goes into starting a club, running a club. And we wanted to figure out a way to just make it easier for any student out there that has an interest in starting a Bitcoin club and recognizes that there's a place for a Bitcoin club and then a separate blockchain club to help them on that path of doing it. And so the Students Network kind of helps on the logistic side. You know, how do you start and run a club? How do you think about planning your meetings? Do you need help with getting speakers? What are best practices? Help on the resources side, you know, actually here, lead this in your meeting here, use this. And then eventually we hope to have the financial piece come in. But we currently now have students, about 115 student leaders across 25 countries that are building and starting clubs, which is just really exciting.
Amazing.
For me. And what's kind of really amazing about it is that not only is it a lot of work to start a club, but you might also think that you're the only person interested in Bitcoin in your local community. And so you might think, no one's going to show up. I'm not going to start this club. That's how I felt. And then I started it and we had like 60 members our first semester.
Wow.
And so you create that space to have these conversations that otherwise wouldn't happen, which is so important. But then being a part of the network, you realize just how many more people there are out there. And it's just the opportunity to be a part of something even bigger than just your local group. Because, so we had a meeting last night for the Cornell Club here, and everyone in the network gets the Zoom link to come in and join. So you can hop into any different club's meeting, just really build up that peer-to-peer aspect.
That is so cool. Hats off to you for the work you're doing. I think that's the important, you know, grassroots level stuff that we need. And, you know, we're seeing Wall Street come into Bitcoin, but there are there's a lot of retail adoption left to be had, I think, before it's no longer possible, you know, on the base layer and sort of where we've been for a long time.
You'd asked a question about what does success look like. And so someone told us this quote that I really liked. We're decentralized, but not disorganized. So really, it's just how can we help provide the resources, make it easier, you know, knock down any barriers there might be. But I think the success that we see is just, you know, more clubs popping up, more students being interested, participating. And today, I don't know if you would have seen this, but I gathered about 180 Gen Z Bitcoiners on Sunday to join me for the first episode of, I started a podcast called Sats Chats, where basically just younger people come and talk and see what they're building. But like, that's what success looks like when we can just have more people involved that are doing awesome things and just highlighting what they're doing. BSN isn't, it's really just seeing other people succeed and thrive, and that's success.
I love it. That's so cool. And I recorded a podcast earlier this week with NVK. And I think one of his famous lines I've heard him say a few times is, over a long enough time horizon, all Bitcoiners become podcast hosts. Yeah. I'm like, here I am, you know? Yeah. But I think, you know, we need more, you know, like there's never too many, because I think everyone's hitting a different demographic, and, you know, their styles resonate with different people in different ways. And I think it's so important. So, love what you're doing. So I'm curious then, as someone in Gen Z who is probably very much predominantly reaching folks in Gen Z, how would you describe like a typical reaction or reception from other Gen Zers when you bring up the topic of Bitcoin? Or is there a typical reaction? I'm sure it ranges, but just in general.
It ranges. It really ranges where you are. Like the group you're talking to, I would say. But I'll tell you, at school, often when I bring it up, everyone just starts laughing. I guess that's better than booing it or something. But most people are really positive. I think it's never a place of, against it necessarily. I think part of it's, I just never considered it. I didn't really know the right question to ask. Mm. But if you go down a line of, again, that, you know, this is your ability to own your money, to preserve your participation in the future, who doesn't want to matter and protect that they matter just from a self-interest perspective? Because most people my age, like, we probably talk about this every day in some way it comes up. It's just how expensive everything is getting. It's really hard for people to still find jobs. And so I only have positive things to say about people's reactions to it.
That's fantastic. And actually, I would have thought, without thinking too hard, my suspicion would have been you'd say, oh, there's, you know, a ton of skepticism, probably some laughter. I could have guessed. Yeah. But actually, I wonder if the fact that people in your generation have grown up with this notion of Bitcoin's existence, right? Like it's not like this is, you know, if maybe that helps them, and you know, unless they come from a very privileged financial background, might already early in their life recognize, you know, what low purchasing power and decreasing purchasing power means. If maybe that's to your advantage, because like as a millennial, you know, I just had an interesting conversation at my barber shop the other day. This guy, he's a friend of my barber. And so he'll just go into the barber shop and sit. It's like an old school barber shop. He'll just go in there and sit and just kind of, you know, rant about whatever. And he was going on and on. I mean, in an expletive ridden rant about our money is so broken and blah, blah, blah. All like, he sounded like the most anarcho-capitalist Bitcoiner you could possibly imagine. And I was like, have you looked at Bitcoin? Like, you sound like a Bitcoiner. He's like, oh no, I had a guy who, but like, he ended up being receptive to my conversation with him about it. But I think most people have, in at least in my generation, have been like preconditioned to the idea that, oh, this is just some sort of scam, because they're still reading the Wall Street Journal, or, you know, more of them are listening to Rogan and some of these more open-minded independent media outlets. But it feels like maybe it's more native to your generation, like this, the idea that Bitcoin exists and maybe it could mean something. They haven't figured it out yet, but it's not something to reject outright. Would you kind of agree with that assessment, perhaps?
Yeah, I think I was five when Bitcoin, I guess, was born. So I didn't totally, well, I mean, I only learned about Bitcoin when I was 17, 18. So for a large portion, I didn't know what it was. And I was also probably pretty skeptical at first. Again, I just really didn't get it. I think part of it was because I was introduced to Bitcoin as a technology, or decentralized ledger technology precisely was how it was presented. And I just didn't grasp the impact on why that mattered for me and why I should spend my time thinking about it. Like, we are just so inundated with information today. And it's really hard to process all of that. I'm reading this book right now called Meditations for Mortals. But anyways, there's a statistic in there where they say, like, in 1999, we had like 1.5 billion gigabytes of data. And now today there's like 147 trillion gigabytes of data. So there is just so much coming at us. So I have a lot of just grace and empathy when talking to my peers about Bitcoin, because they have so much coming at them. But we have grown up, like, we have digital communication, everyone texts, we're not, you know, writing letters or leaving notes. All of our photos really exist on our phones. We don't carry around like cameras or print photos. So I think from that sense, the digital aspect just aligns well with us. But I still think there's some learning to do on, you know, Bitcoin itself. It's not just immediately obvious, unless, yeah. I don't know, so it may be a unique scenario, but I wouldn't say it's just immediate.
Yeah, it's easy, I think, for us as Bitcoiners to say, well, we all get Bitcoin at the price we deserve. And there's certainly some truth in that. But I think it overlooks the fact that there is so much noise and there's so much distraction. And absolutely kudos to the guys who have been around for, you know, 15 years now. Mm-hmm. And many of them, you know, for every one of them who sold off their Bitcoin because it reached, you know, $50 or something. And then there's another guy who's still working in the Bitcoin space, building, and has, you know, profited tremendously. But I think that's a good way of framing it, is, you know, like bringing some humility and grace to this conversation with people, because they are inundated with so much. They've seen the FTX collapse, and as far as they're concerned, from the outside looking in, that had something to do with Bitcoin, right? And so, like, now there's like a new hurdle for us as Bitcoin educators to get over in reaching those people. I'm wondering, do you think that Gen Z, like, in light of the current macroeconomic environment, do you think that Gen Z might be uniquely primed to adopt Bitcoin, you know, more quickly than perhaps previous generations?
Yeah, I think definitely, again, from the, you know, what are your assumptions? What has been your operating system that you've been working off of for so long? I think American HODL is opening to the cheat code conference last year. He used this analogy about, like, operating system, and are you going to update your operating system? And Bitcoin's just like this better language. And also, most of us, well, I'll say my immediate peers, are really starting to get our first paychecks, like really starting to think about what are we investing in, what are we saving in. For me, my parents felt it was really important, back to like respect and responsibility, to have a job as soon as possible. So I was, I think 15 was when I could legally like start scooping ice cream. So I did. But then my first real job was at IBM, and I was on their corporate social responsibility team, leading their STEM for Girls program. And so when I got that first real paycheck, we had the conversation again of, okay, Ella, you know, are you going to spend this, save this? What are you thinking? Like, let's just talk about this. And so I had those conversations maybe a little bit earlier than the average person does, but now we're all getting into that. And so when I talk to people, sometimes they mention, yeah, like I want to buy Bitcoin, but I need to get my paycheck first and then I'll allocate some over. So yes, I think I'm hugely hopeful on them adopting it. And also, I think there's a lot of room to come be a part of building this space and the different companies in it. And I touched a little bit on just the internships and recruiting in universities now, and a process that a lot of different students are coming in. And so Bitcoin, not only as this thing that they could store their energy and store their wealth in, but also that they can be a part of helping to shape and build and develop skills and make an impact is also meaningful.
Yeah. I hope more and more of those people find, what'd you call it, Sats Chats, before they find a traditional financial advisor. Because unfortunately, I think without a lot of thought or consideration, they might make the same mistakes that a lot of people have made and miss out on, you know, a massive asymmetric opportunity. And, you know, again, it's not all about number go up. It's the freedom and the agency, the self-sovereignty that Bitcoin provides, that it sounds to me like you were conditioned very early on to understand and appreciate the importance that, you know, frankly, just a lot of kids didn't have that growing up. But, you know, I think as more people suffer the consequences of fiat, the more open-minded they'll be to some of these things. So I hope they find you before they find their nearest financial advisor.
Yeah. And just a quick shout. So Fidelity put out a really good report maybe this summer about people's perceptions toward digital assets, Bitcoin, and younger generations, it's like 60%+ have a positive opinion towards it.
That's very good. I don't know that I would have guessed it would be that high.
It's really high. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because the Bitcoin way, most of what we do is Bitcoin self-custody. Mm-hmm. And when I joined the team, I was surprised to find that we have a really large swath of baby boomer clients. And I was thinking it would be a lot of millennials who just kind of picked it up. I have a feeling it's a lot of, converted gold bugs, people who really understand. I mean, we're helping 80+ year olds run their own nodes. Yeah. And I wonder if maybe they kind of remember before fiat and the Nixon gold shock and all of these things. And now maybe this new generation of Gen Z is paying the price or anticipates paying the price for all of the shenanigans that have been played. And they're going to be open to something different. So that's promising. I love that. Could you tell me a little bit about the job that you've secured after graduation, and then we'll start heading for home?
Yes. So I graduate in May, and then I will be going to work with Gridless in Kenya for 3 months, from about June to August, just gaining some technical skills, just really hands-on learning. And I just said, put me to work. I just want to learn as much as I can. And then I will go back to Galaxy, where I was this past summer, and join their Bitcoin mining team full-time in the city.
What will you be doing there specifically?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not entirely sure what the exact day-to-day is going to look like, but my internship this summer, I had different projects from, you know, like ASIC market research to what's going on with ERCOT and the Texas legislature to, you know, what's the future of Bitcoin mining, really all areas. So Galaxy has a site in West Texas called Helios. And so it will be just anything to support the missions of what they're up to.
Okay. Are you going to be based in West Texas, or are you?
No, I'll be in New York City. Yeah. Okay. In the office there.
Okay. Yes. Terrific. Alrighty. So, putting your thinking cap here, if if you could wave a magic wand and suddenly the world was on a Bitcoin standard, and let's just assume that a lot of the bumps that at least I personally anticipate coming with a transition to a Bitcoin standard, all that's been resolved. What do you think is the biggest and most impactful positive change that you think we would see from this shift?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Probably I would look at it from kind of small to large. So what I mean by that is, what does it do for each human? And then how does that ladder up? What's the larger impact? And so just in my own life, thinking about what Bitcoin has done for me thus far, since in April, it'll be, I guess, my first 4 years. The future is uncertain. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. But if we think about what type of person do I want to be, what values do I want to live my life by, that can really help clarify the decisions that we make and how we go about our, you know, every day. And so the values of Bitcoin, as we spoke about earlier, were really impactful to me. And so if we have more of that, where truth and, you know, actual value is rewarded, I think we'll have just a better base layer to start thinking about, you know, really hard problems in this world and get to the fix the world part of, you know, fix the money, fix the world. Like, once we can fix the money, and then we have a better base layer to build off of, and where we have people that now have savings so they can select what they put their time and energy on. They can select what they think about, more agency over, you know, what they do. I think hopefully it just sets the basis for what today is unimaginable. So in short, to answer your question, I'm not entirely sure what, you know, the biggest ultimate positive impact will be, but it gives us the tools of how, you know, we just live out our day to day through the values to then set us up for that. That hopefully came across clear.
Yeah, no, I like that way of framing it. It's like the broader implications all stem from this idea of people having agency, self-sovereignty, their financial incentives being realigned toward, you know, a more productive life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great answer. So last question for you. And I know when I ask you this question, I know you're very measured, you're very thoughtful in how you address these things. So no pressure to go too big, but what is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if it offends any Bitcoiners out there?
Yeah. So you did send me that before. So I had a few moments to just kind of try to put some thoughts together. And I came up with two, because I didn't want my first one to appear like a cop out. My first one, though, is that I don't particularly like unpopular opinions. And it's probably, I want to frame it correctly. I think often we just have in society this want to kind of foster difference or distance when perhaps it's not there. And I'll just tell a little story of what helped me come to this framing. So when I was making the decision that I am going to move to China, when I don't speak Chinese at all and I don't know anyone there, basically everyone, most people around me told me that was a bad idea and I shouldn't do it. Aside from my parents, they were very supportive. And a lot of people were just equating that China was really far away, that distance equaled difference, basically. And, you know, when I got there, so I mentioned I'm from Houston, my host family listened to country music every night, which I was totally not expecting. Whenever my host father would come home from work, I had two host sisters, they would run to the door and greet him. Like the same I used when my dad got home, I'd run down the stairs and, you know, see him. And so, you know, at the end of the day, like, humans around the world, we all want the same thing. We want our families, community, just, you know, feel like we matter and have purpose. So to tying back, why I don't love unpopular opinions is that I think often they're not actually based on fact or truth. So in some ways they can be unproductive. And I wish we focused more on, you know, what's like an unknown opinion, or what's something that really fosters discussion or disagreeability in a productive way. So that's probably like my first unpopular opinion, is that I just wish we could, you know, focus on real substance. But my second one, because I didn't want that one to appear like a cop out, and this one is probably, so I'm not sure there's a ton of benefit to defining generations, which is maybe a little surprising given I talk a lot about Gen Z and just the importance of Bitcoin for my generation. And I'll say, I think there is real benefit to, you know, being able to foster belonging and feel like you have a community and a group of people. But also what Bitcoin has really highlighted to me as well is that, you know, our community is, it's your neighbor, it's anyone. It doesn't necessarily matter the age. You can, you know, find community in all of the people around you. And so, you know, that's one another, maybe less emphasis on just, you know, age creating these divides throughout society. And another kind of story to go with this, and China had a really big impact on my life. So I apologize that often my examples are rooted there. But I did this interview with a girl at a Chinese high school that we went to visit. And she brought up this distinction between Dongxi and Shiqing. So I apologize for my tones as well. But basically, Dongxi is the word for a material object. And Shiqing is the word for like a non-material, non-physical object. It's more about like the thoughts and beliefs. And often generations kind of have these demarcations, I think, yes, by an event or maybe a physical technology or something that really led to different shifts. But Bitcoin is like this idea. It's not a physical, tangible thing. It's made physical in each human in the network. So that's just kind of another piece that maybe my unpopular opinion is I don't love the different divides between generations.
No, I think that's great. You you handled that very tactfully and thoughtfully. I mean, the last couple of episodes I've done, we've had that Bitcoin isn't for poor people. COVID was a bioweapon. Like, I mean, so I think you're good. You handled that one well. But Ella, why don't you, first of all, thank you so much for your time. Why don't you give people a handoff where they can find you? Some of these things that you've talked about, where can they learn more about it? I would love for people to dive in and get involved with some of what you're working on.
Yeah, I would love that. Well, I think, you know, Twitter is probably the best place. It's just 21mm for the 21st, 21 million for the 21st century is my handle. But you can, my website's just ellahuff.io, and it'll link you to everything. And if you're a student, please definitely reach out, because would love to, one, just know you. But two, if you would like any help with starting a Bitcoin club or just finding, you know, local young Bitcoiners near you, please let me know. And would love to support you with that.
Fantastic. Love what you're doing, Ella. Thank you so much for making time, and hopefully we can catch up again soon.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Michael.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Go check out Ella, everything she's doing. Follow her on Twitter. Go check out her website. Some amazing stuff, especially if you're a bit younger. I think a lot of what she talks about and the way she approaches the topic of Bitcoin is going to resonate. Of course, if you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you do it right the first time. It is important to do this properly and securely. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones, Plan B residency options. So again, that's thebitcoinway.com/podcast, where you can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. If you're enjoying the podcast, do me a huge favor, like, subscribe, share this with someone who you think might be interested in what we're talking about here. I would really, really appreciate that. And you can follow us on X. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can follow me there as well, @theothermjordan. In the meantime, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.